Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Smashbox TV Podcast 504's After Show.
I got to go on Tour Life today, right before Prez. I was the headliner. He was like,
you should go on tour.
He was like, just this afterthought.
So
they focused. They really, I mean, you were right. You bring on the guest first. Like if you watch any late night TV show, you don't bring on the animal guy first.
No.
You bring on the headliner.
Yeah, that's what you are.
So
yeah. How did, what was the premise?
It was a ratings.
Are they trying to recruit you? Cause I could dump you in a second.
No, they're not. Yeah. They couldn't handle this jelly. yeah. No, there was a little bit of ratings talk on the social medias. Brody had mentioned how, you know, we shouldn't be ratings, something along the lines, ratings are broken. We shouldn't be using them in the Pro Tour environment, whether for graphics, for stats or anything like that he doesn't necessarily like them. He had thrown out we should use score instead. We went back and forth just real quickly. It wasn't combative or anything, but just saying my point was, hey, guess what? Score doesn't equate when you want to look at it. And he's like, well, you can just look at the whole field. If someone shoots a four down and they're leading and everyone else is shooting ones and twos, you can probably assume that the course is hard or the weather was bad. He's like, but then, and I'm like, yeah, then you still have to gather the information. You still have to do research. He didn't like that. You know, if Andrew Presnell's 1040 or 1041, whatever that was one of the lower rated major wins in the last couple of years. He doesn't think that equates, you know, it makes people question. And I said, well, you're doing just as much research if you want to find that out versus,
Lowest score was. Like, I guess my point, if you want to look at scores, I can understand that. Well, I guess.
Well, because low scores don't necessarily equate to low ratings. It all depends on, like, I had a whole talk with our good friend Chuck Kennedy about course SSA and how it happens and why is a six down on one course rated 1040 or 1050 or 1060, and another course it could be rated 990. You know, there's so many different variables.
I get that, but I'm saying if you just exclusively look at scores, if Isaac won, I'm just gonna make up a number and say won at 39 under last year, and this year Andrew wins at 15 under, Somebody wants to put some quantitative difference on that other than just the simple subtraction of 24, right? Mm-hmm. Like 39 minus the 15. Ratings are just one possible additional way to quantify, like.
Yeah, it's no better or worse than other ways. I feel it's just different. I said, I don't think ratings are perfect. I think they have their flaws. I think that You know, you could argue maybe that however UDisc does it, maybe theirs is a better way. I don't know. I'm not extremely familiar with them. I know they have a slightly different way where, like, the closer you get to, I think, 18 under par, the more those strokes count for ratings.
Sure.
So it's not an even percentage of, you know, your SSA and all the stuff like the PDGAs is. So there's room to. I don't know if one's better than the other. I'm not a statistician.
I feel like
that's things for smarter people. But we have a system, and that system is, I think, a relatively good bar to look at and compare between different rounds and different areas and different courses. But I don't see a problem, because I kind of feel like if you're going to throw out the whole ratings don't matter, then you absolutely shouldn't be celebrating if Kristen Tatar gets to 1,000.
Yeah. And that's always been one of my major challenges. I feel like I often hear players say how they don't matter and they're screwed up and they're wrong, and then turn around and the next day are posting about
how mad they are
that it just went down and it's BS, or how awesome it is that it just went up and it's their new high.
And they're like,
which is it?
There are definite ways to massage the your rating. Like, you can shoot, let's just say you're a 950 rated player. You could probably get to 960, 970 just by playing certain events with certain players and certain course SSAs. Like, going to play the Memorial, if you played the Memorial every single year and that was the only event you played, your rating would probably be a little inflated.
Sure. There is some advantage to
play with
certain
better
scenarios.
To play with higher rated players and things like that, as opposed to...
You know who also hits more home runs in the major league?
The guy with the aluminum bat.
Or Sammy Sosa.
The guy with the corked bat.
Or
the guy,
people in Colorado.
Because the air and the field and all this
stuff. Or, you know, the people that play at a certain field that have a shorter left field that's more advantageous to, you know, the right-handed batters. I mean, there's always going to be, like, some of these slight advantages or slight tweaks. I can't even think if you really want to get, like, really granular, and I am by no means any kind of sports nut, but if you named a sport, I could probably name some advantage that could be taken when it's played in one place versus another. If you want to get, like, insanely nitpicky. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about things that have, like, set and static things, like a bowling alley. No, every bowling alley is a little different. Patterns are different. Lanes react differently. Like,
I think basketball is a pretty controlled environment. You same size court, same type of probably flooring.
Obviously, with the exception, but that's a team sport, so there's a ton of other variables that can come into play there. I'm even just trying to think of an individual sport, like darts. I bet you darts fly a little bit different even in Colorado than they do in Florida.
Yeah, quite
I mean, it, we're talking like 0.0001% probably. Mm-hmm. But there's no 100%, you know, duplicatable scenario where everything's going to be absolutely perfect and identical to the next place that it's played or competed at.
Yeah.
Maybe there is. I don't know. I guess that's kind of my point, though. My bigger point to the whole ratings is, there's always going to be some variance to some degree in some capacity, and somebody, I think it's, and again, I know it goes back to, it's not an individual sport, but even somebody that may have there's got to be some correlation to somebody having more home runs in one field versus another, or a higher batting average or whatever, due to the, whether it's the air or the, you know, the fence line, so to speak, or whatever, the outfield walls. They call it a fence line still? I guess, what would you call that? The outer outfield wall?
Yeah, the outfield wall.
Outfield fence? I guess that's what you'd call it. When I think fence, I think of, like, chain link. I don't think of they currently
That's funny, because I think of wooden fence.
Either way, neither are in the MLBs. That's my point.
Yeah.
Anyway, indoor kickers in the NFL. Sure, but indoor versus outdoor. Like there's always, yeah, obviously not just from a wind, just from a humidity and temperature standpoint.
Yeah. And the funny thing, I think of someone who plays down in easy there, Tom Brady, you don't need to deflate any balls in Dallas, where the punter occasionally will hit the screen that's up there, the jumbotron, and they have to actually literally adjust for some of that stuff. Like,
yeah, that ain't fair.
And not tell me about it.
Yes, Glenn, happy birthday to your wife.
If she's listening, I'm sorry. For you and her.
Yeah, that is no way to spend a birthday with us two. Unless we're in downtown Emporia.
If we're in person, then we're...
Then maybe, but otherwise, no. You that's too bad. Mark says, if Brody doesn't like ratings, why did he celebrate with a commemorative disc with a big 1,000 on it? I know that was a little bit of a joke
early.
and a poke a little bit even from Brody, and he said it would be like the one time they did so many of them. But you're not entirely wrong.
I'll give him a slide on that. It was pretty early in his career. He got up there really quick before he really got on tour. I will say the best joke I heard.
Let me be clear. Yeah. I like it, but you're right. If that's why I say I feel like so many pros generically. I'm not saying Brody. I'm just saying so many pros generically, like. They rip on them so much and say they don't matter and they don't care, and then turn around and fast forward
and talk about them.
And then they talk about them.
Well, again, the funniest joke, and no, nothing against Brody, that I saw was, is he going to do another one when he gets back down to 1,000? Encore.
None of that matters to me.
No, it's clearly just a joke, because he even admits he's not been playing well, and he just started practicing again, is what he said on the podcast. Mm. So good for him. Obviously, it's always, to me, just note that I was on the Tour Life podcast.
You're big time now.
I am not. I try not to be. I mean, I'm big. I am tall. I'm still I didn't shrink much, but it's always good. We're all friends. We're all friendly. It's good cross promotion. We're always happy when, you know, Brody or Yuli or tonight Brian was the guest. Come on our show and we'll go on their show. And, you know, Terry and I are always open to talking about things because we like to talk.
I am now going to be at the Dynamic Disc Open, which was not on the schedule or planned. I got a call from our producer a week ago, roughly, and asked if I would be interested. So one of the new things that's going to get implemented this weekend is myself on the chase card, or maybe come Friday, you'd call it the second feature card. As that annoys me, so I want to make it right. I will be on that card.
It could still be called the chase card. They're still chasing that lead card. They're still behind them. They're still
No, they're not, though. They're in front of them.
Damn.
It's the stupidest, subtle mistake,
know.
But I will admit, I do my damnedest on day one to not refer to them.
Maybe they're getting chased.
To not refer to them as a leader chase card, because no, they're not. They are handpicked.
But what if the leader's on that card?
Featured cards.
Which is rare, because usually, as we know, the numbers tend to go higher.
Yeah.
So, but by the time that lead card finishes, there's already
It is not a lead or a chase card day one. And you have the right to yell at me, even though the second I say it, I will already recognize and know that I messed up. But yes, I try my damnedest to not refer to it as a lead or chase card when they are going out. Anyway, so I'll be out there. And I think I will then also assist potentially with some interviews if something were to happen, and I'll just make up
a story. Will the players go to the Bourbon Cowboy for those?
I sat up there.
Yeah, I'm assuming you're
not leaving. There at 4 p.m., so I leave midway through the round to get a good seat at the Mechanical Bull.
Yeah, you're going
to
ride the bull.
Of course. No. So I will likely get peel away if there's any interviews that need to take place. If we need to check in, somebody comes in with a hot round or something like that, I may then go move off of the second feature or chase card and then go conduct some interviews. I'll fill in some of those roles in some of that capacity. So what I'm most excited about is the fact that I'm going to be there and assisting in whatever way that is needed, as I have been not assigned to be on site for any of the events, doing any sideline stuff, because we have Nate Perkins, because we have Brian Earhart. Those guys are kind of the official staple people. So Yeah. So I'm excited.
Shout out to Mark Hill, who says
his wife too.
His wife's birthday too, and she's listening in the background. So
well, happy birthday,
Miss Hill, Mrs. Hill, whatever you would want to go by, Madame Hill. I don't know. Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. Yeah, happy B-Day to all the wives out there. So, yes, I'll see maybe some of you this weekend. And it's definitely going to be exciting to be down there on site. We know that Champions Landing has a little bit of a redesign, specifically hole number 18. Mm-hmm. I think that was made known this weekend by Eric McCabe making some posts about it. So we're going to see a different
spot. I'm really interested in seeing how that plays, the way where the tee box is, because I don't think the tee box has really moved much.
I don't think it is either.
They're going to be throwing to probably that same spot and then throwing over to the where the old basket was and then making the island. I don't know. I would have to take a look at it to see, is anyone going to be able to go for an Eagle 3 on that at all? I think that would be very difficult for the MPO. But again, we'll see how it plays out. Well, actually, I won't. I probably won't watch much at all this weekend, Terry, because on Friday I'm taking the day off and myself and some of our buddies are going to play Standing Rocks Open this weekend.
Must be nice.
It is, actually. It is. I'm going up about 3 hours from here and I'm going to play in an event, going to play in MP40. I have not thrown a disc this year. So this is always a good way to start.
You and Eagle, I mean, you guys are starting at the same. No, I guess he's starting, thrown more discs.
He's thrown more discs than I have.
But he's played in one more event than you now.
That's true. He has. So he's got a leg up on me.
So you guys are pretty much equal.
He's got a wing up on me.
Yeah.
I have done a little bit of putting in my backyard, but I literally haven't thrown a disc many, many moons. So I am eager to find out how poorly I'm going to play. The good thing, those courses are very well known to me. They haven't changed in about two decades. There's a few new holes, I think a couple of years ago, but for the most part, they're identical to what we're used to playing. So it's just going to be hopefully Friday, me just getting in a bunch of reps, assuming the weather is nice, to get used to what's going on. So if you happen to be at Standing Rocks, say hi.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I saw today that, unless I was confused, which is possible, that Cale LaVisca appeared to be in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I don't know how many other Green Bays there are. It'd be weird if there was a Green Bay.
I'm sure Minnesota, there's other Green Bays.
I know. I'm sure there are, but I don't know if there's one in Minnesota. But Cale seemingly has a course design project that looks like it's taking place here in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Now, Cale lives in Minnesota, west of Green Bay by about probably 4.5-5 hours. So it wouldn't be crazy, obviously, if he was over here. But it looks like he's got a course design that's taking place up in Green Bay.
That's funny. I wonder where it is in Green Bay.
It's at what I believe is an... He first said something about UW Green Bay, and then he went on to say it was a golf course that shut down in 2020. And he says he's got about 60 acres to work with. So... excited to see what's going to come of that.
Is he playing? Sometimes he registers. I'm going to take a look, see if he's there. He is registered. Cale, this event has been a little sketchy sometimes for Cale. He has he's registered and sometimes not shown up Standing Rock. So I will see, hopefully, Cale this weekend. He is the right now leading candidate to take down the event. He's 1034 rated, the next closest to him. A good friend, Danny Polk, who's rated 1,002. But if Cale's there, I will make sure to give him, maybe I'll get a chance to play with him. I mean, there's a lot of people in that
first round.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. First round.
just so everybody's clear.
I mean, if I'm playing with him second round,
you should pay for the feature card.
I should. If I'm playing with him second round, either something has gone terribly wrong with Cale,
like he's playing left-handed,
like maybe he's playing left-handed, or I had the
greatest round of your life,
the greatest round of my life. Yeah. One
those
of the
are
other.
The two. Those are, I mean, the two scenarios.
It's unlikely we meet in the middle.
Yeah,
because I don't see that happening to Cale.
Because a really, really, really good round for you
is going to be like
and
a really, really terrible
round for
him.
It's
like 980
still separates you.
Correct. Like a great round for me right now. I feel like if I came out and shot a 1080, I'd be really happy with that. Like really?
980, yeah.
Or 980, yeah. Or whatever. 1080. 1080, I'd be happy with that. Well.
Would you be happy with that?
So I think someone would question my scorecard at that point.
Yes.
If I shot a 980 and if Kale shot a 980, I think that there's an issue. So there's if I'm lucky, I get to shoot with him first round. But maybe I'll be in a card near him and I'll be able to say hi.
You could be on the second chase card day one. There's something like that.
Where right now I am the 7th lowest rated player.
Oh, out of 53.
Out of 53. I'm hoping to finish above that. I'm not fooling myself to think I'm going to get into cash, but I'd like to be just a few strokes out if I'm lucky.
All right.
That's my goal. Set your
Jeremy on the board says Pamprin is a great course in the GB area. Yeah, played Pamprin Park many moons ago. Tim says you need to play in the Wisconsin Illinois Border Championship, Johnny V.
Ooh, when and where?
Well, I think it's one round down at Round Lake and then one round at Silver. That's Ryan Pilcher runs that.
Oh, well, it depends on the weekend. And
yeah, did you ever pick a date on that, Ryan? I know you were looking into it, but. I don't know that there's a heck of a lot of other things that were out of the ordinary. I didn't post any pictures yet, but I did have the pleasure. We went out and actually played 9 holes after everything on Sunday.
That's nice. Was that you and the whole family? Because I saw a picture of you and Sharon.
Yeah. Sharon Jenkins, Val's mom, Nate's mother-in-law, also mom to Avery Jenkins, just to put it all together. Sharon has done a ton of work over on this course called, I got to look. She's done a ton of work. Her and another group of people have put together these beautiful tee pads where otherwise was a bunch of just dirt pits for many years. Now they put in some giant pavers, have made like 5x10 tee pads that are phenomenal. She's running a junior event there, and then she's going to be running the women's global event there as well in that area. So just a ton of work, and she continues to do a ton of work. So they put in these brand new tee pads. She's working on some new pin placements and baskets and all that really good stuff. But it was myself, Sharon, Val and Nate, along then of course with little Luca in a little buggy stroller thing. We got 9 holes in.
Very nice.
And there's going to be some news.
How much did Luca beat you by?
There's going to be some news about Nate Doss and Val coming up here soon.
Coming up to Wisconsin soon?
No, just
just coming up as in the
coming up in the news.
Coming up in
and
the
I,
news.
I don't want to spoil it yet, but I'll tease it out there that it's some good stuff going on. Oh, Mark.
Yeah, Mark Hill.
Thank you. See, the money you saved on not getting your wife a card, we appreciate here at Smashbox. Thank you for the super chat. Seriously. Tom says Shorewood Golf Course. Thank you. There you go. Tom says Shorewood Golf Course, UW Green Bay Course. So is that like, it just was funny because he said UW Green Bay. So does the university own a golf course?
It might.
And what confused me for a moment when he mentioned it is UWGB has a golf course, a disc golf course. I want to say it's 9 holes. I played it forever ago.
2 years ago, there was an article saying the UW Green Bay closed their 90-year-old golf course, which was Shorewood.
Making way for Student Recreation Center. Huh.
So in part of that Student Recreation Center will be a disc golf course, clearly
apparently
designed by Cale LaVisca, which is great because I drive through Green Bay quite a bit on my way up to Door County to visit in-laws. And one of these days, I'm just going to make the family stop and drop me off. Make them go to lunch or something, and I'll go play. I'll get some disc golf in.
Update for you. Pilcher says June 9th for the Masters. So there you go. Johnny will be there.
I don't know about that, but
his new sponsor, Paul Macbeth, will pay for him to
and a couple bags, Paul. Just saying.
Yes.
Just, I mean,
if you sell the bags, then you could make some money.
I will not accept anything less than what Prez gets. I am the VP, VD. I'm the vice something.
D bag.
Yeah, with that too. wait, he said June 9th. That's Beaver State Fling Weekend. That's the weekend I'm actually directing for the Pro Tour. Because yeah,
you could swing it. You're talented.
Could I do both?
You could.
Because I'm supposed to do MPO. Supposed to do MPO and FPO. But no, that's otherwise that weekend I was going to register for. I believe that is Wilderness here in up in Wisconsin. So sorry.
Well, I don't like how you have your calendar set up.
How so?
That you have Saturday and Sunday on. I mean, I understand it.
Well, some of us that work Monday through Friday, Monday is the start of our week, so it's at the left.
Oh, and see, I just work 7 days a week. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
You probably put Thursday first because you don't care. You're a weirdo.
No, I'm looking at it on his calendar. And again, I understand it. It's just not normal.
Yeah, because my calendar starts Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, because that's
and
my week.
Saturday and Sunday, on the far right.
It's easier because especially if I have 2 day events or something I'm doing all weekend, it's not split up on each side. It's less confusing for me.
I understand it. It's just not normal. That's clearly a setting within your Google
calendar. Sure it is. Yeah, I'm sure I set it years ago. It's not traditional for like a paper calendar, but I feel like for the digital calendar, it makes more sense for me that for the most part, this side is work, this side is weekend.
What was the question that we had? Before we started the show.
So Terry was questioning, at your house, if you have two vehicles, usually husband, wife, do you always park on the same side of the driveway? So do you have a designated side, so to speak? Kind of like sleeping in a bed. If I'm looking at the bed, I'm standing at the foot and looking at the bed, I'm always on the left-hand side. My wife is always on the right-hand side. When it comes to our driveway, usually my wife likes to park on the right. If you're looking up the driveway from the road, and I park on the left for a couple of reasons. One, her car's bigger. She doesn't like to park under. We have a tree that kind of hangs over the driveway a little bit. She doesn't like to park under that because it'll drop things on her car. But on top of that, it's a little bit lower. During the winter, I park in the garage. Terry thought it was strange because last week he came in and I think the cars were opposite. And so we had this discussion about, do you have a designated side of a driveway that you park on? And I said, normally we kind of do, but we also have an assistant who comes in and helps with my daughter, helps bring her home from school, work with her after school for special needs stuff. So sometimes, depending on who gets home first, they just park on the opposite side of wherever she decided to park. Because I don't think she has a designated side because she's willy-nilly.
She should, clearly, by now.
She doesn't. Sometimes she's on the right, sometimes she's on the left. She's just... I think it depends on if she picks my daughter up from school with the car, she's coming in, and I assume she makes a wider turn and parks on the left, versus if she comes in, parks on the right with the wider turn, then gets out and walks the block and a half, depending on weather. So I think maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. I'm not in her brain. She's a 21-year-old college kid who I have no clue what she's thinking. So, but that's how a lot of determined. So if she's parked on one side, I get home first, I'll park on the opposite, she'll leave. My wife will pull in. So there can be some fluctuation in our parking
situation. Yeah, that's effed up.
We live wild.
A
here,
couple
Terry.
Of people have chimed in and said, yes, like a bed.
So
yeah, you typically, I feel like most households that are set up in this capacity that have two parking spaces, we'll say outside of your house or outside of your garage, typically... I feel like one would always grab the same side. And to follow that up, even from go as far as saying like a safety perspective, like you would think you'd get to know, like it's more common then, and you would get to know and be more familiar with every day you're backing out. It's the same.
If you can't back out from the right versus the left of a driveway.
No, you're going to accidentally fall into your own ditch. I just think of like, just
no.
Yeah. Just from a consistency standpoint, it would be a little bit more.
You're in a different situation because you live in a condo. So you don't have, you probably either have a designated spot, literally a spot, or one of a few you could take right in your upper lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you going to do? Imagine if you lived in a place like this and suddenly your daughter Allie gets a car. How do you designate?
I think there would, some
you think some
norm would get established and it would always stay that way.
I don't think so, because the way kids come and go at different times, I think it would be difficult to say, oh, you know, I'm always going to park here and you're always going to park behind mom. Well, you can't, because this, I think once you have a kid, it kind of throws a big monkey wrench into it, or a third vehicle, we'll say a third driver, whoever that may be. It probably, with a two car wide driveway, probably throws a little monkey wrench into it. Now, I will say this, and I've shot my wife down for now. She has talked about possibly wanting a turnaround, because we have a lot of space off just past the house, and we could, in theory, have a turn, you know, where whatever. Yeah. I don't like that idea. I've told her no, just because I think
it's, I mean, is she just lazy? She doesn't want to back out?
Well, when we're going to have, I mean, the good thing is we're hopefully only have to worry about having my son here for a few years with a vehicle. And honestly, I said, well, who has to snowblow that? You're going to get out and snowblow that when there's a lot more? And she's like, well, of course not. You're going to. And I said, well, then we're not doing it, because I don't want to snowblow. One of the things I love about this house is that the driveway is smaller than what it's. The driveway itself is bigger than the old house that we were in, but I don't have to snowblow an entire alley behind my house, which I had to before, because that was part of my job. That was part of owning the house, is that we snowblowed the alley portion directly behind us, which was a giant pain because there's no place to put the snow except for in Chipotle's lot, which is what I did. I threw it into there, but it wasn't ideal. So anyway, left or right to me, for parking the car, it doesn't matter.
I tend
to go into the left side, because if there's nobody else there, it's easier.
Here's the one question is, if you didn't have the babysitter that is here either frequently or infrequently, mm-hmm. or occasionally or whatever, if you never had a third car here, do you feel like you would have an established norm? Maybe that's the better
question. We probably would
because would slide what in. You're saying with the inconsistency of the babysitter, which I wouldn't go for, what you're saying there, I understand how you've arrived at this cluster F that you have going on out there. That is your parking, your driveway. But
I prefer to call it a dicker shit. Thanks.
If you didn't have that third car and it was just the two of you always every single day,
we would probably fall into some sort of pattern, just because my wife, if we didn't have the tree there, I think it would be less likely, just because I know she doesn't like to park underneath of that tree. Again, I personally don't.
She afraid
care.
About hitting her head on it or what?
No, she's always afraid like a branch is going to fall off, or the fact that in the fall it does drop all these like orange, almost like pine needles, but they're not. I don't think they're pine needles, but they cover the car, and so for like a couple weeks.
I wouldn't want to park under those either.
Yeah, I don't personally care, because you normally by about fall is when I'm looking at clean, make sure the garage is clean so I can park in there. She can't park in there for two reasons. One, her car is pretty big. She's got a Grand Cherokee. So she really would have to squeeze it in there based on how the garage is configured. My little Honda Fit without a problem. But second of all, she has remote start on her vehicle. So she can warm up her car without having to go outside. Mm-hmm. My 2009 vehicle ain't got that. Mm. And in fact, my 2009 vehicle might not even have regular start if I keep the way it goes. Because the last week when I put my key into the ignition, I have to jiggle it to get it all the way in. So I think maybe the tumblers that set the key that allow you to turn it are having an issue, because I kind of have to jiggle it to make sure it goes all the way in before I can turn it.
Oh, so you have a key. I
literally have a key, Terry. It's 2009. I was about to YouTube if I could replace the key with a remote or a button start, and how difficult that would be if I could do it myself, if I could just have and then get a key fob like a aftermarket. And I'm like, do I really want to invest what's probably going to be like $2,000 or something into this key fob for my 2009 Honda Fit? I'm like, probably not. So I have not looked it up yet as to far as if it's possible or how much it would cost. Here's a question. Terry, what is the number that you would invest if that was the case? If you could
in your car or mine?
In my, well, you already have probably a push button, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And that's my point.
In my car, if you're looking at my car, like 2009 Honda Fit, and I said,
and that became your primary way to then start your car?
Yeah. If I could then dump my key, like what is that number that you think
because,
would be worth it?
Is it exclusively remote start, or is it so that you turn it into one without,
I
zoned out for a second.
Oh, just a button start. Just if I could replace the key with a button start.
First of all, I don't trust you doing that.
No, anybody. If anybody could do it, like, what is the number? Like, what's the value? My car is a 2009. It's got 115,000.
In your particular car, I wouldn't. I wouldn't invest more than $300 in that.
$300. Okay, that's a number.
In your particular car, I wouldn't. In a newer car.
Oh, sure.
That, you know, was going to for sure or likely last you another 10 or 15 years. I would think, like, it's such a weird thing to think about upgrading, but I don't know. I'd put maybe $750 on that value. The value of doing that.
Brody's harassing us on our board right now about scores and ratings. I'm not going to, you can't tempt me, Brody. Sorry. We already talked about this. You cut me off to have Prez on, even though clearly I was the opener. So no, I'm just kidding. Another time we'll have that conversation another time. As far as, we did say that, we did say maybe it could be advantageous to have tour only stats. To take just because there, like we said, there are ways you can massage if you're like a Presnell or a Yuli who used to play a bunch of B tiers, it could affect your stats. Maybe having tour only rating would be a little bit more accurate, but I don't think personally. I think it all washes out in the long run amongst a year worth of stats. But I could see how that wouldn't be the worst idea.
I feel like, and maybe it's an old take, or not by. I think Yuli years ago, and I'm sure others, was that once you get to 1,000, you no longer need to know what someone's rating is or hide it or get rid of it or move it or whatever. Like after 1,000, it doesn't matter. Mm. I don't know why we would then be like, oh, okay, you're over 1,000. Let's just hide it. Like that to me has never made sense. I'm pretty certain that Yuli has said that.
Yeah, I think he did in the past. Like I think that's a different take. A thousand.
And so like, I just wonder in what other sports,
and 1,000 isn't the same as what it was now versus what it was 5 years ago.
Yeah. And then maybe that's another question. And then that would be even a better point is at what point, where's that arbitrary line that you do hide it? If there is a thought of like, hey, at a certain point we hide it and it's not 1,000. Then I think the idea is really, then I think it's beyond stupid. If you're going to be like, oh, 1,008. Now we're no longer showing you what it is. No. It's like that's such an arbitrary number. 1,000 at least is like a round number that has said something for a long time.
And there is something nice.
It's clearly significant, but any number, if you were to ever move forward on that concept, any other number that's not 1,000, I feel like would be absolutely even dumber.
And here's what I'll say. I don't think I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I don't think in our lifetime we're going to see a significant change to the ratings. I think ratings are here to stay. Maybe you'll see a little bit of a tweak of a formula or so. Like Chuck Kennedy was saying how the Northwood course, they don't even have a bucket. He was explaining how they don't even have a bucket for the difficulty because there are 6 current buckets based on the SSA. It's probably
a higher SSA.
And it's so high. It's such a high SSA that his bucket stopped at 72. This was a 76 SSA. So like I could see a little bit of fluctuation in that, but I don't think you're going to see a significant change to what the way the ratings are. Like, I don't believe you're ever going to see the PDGA go, cool, we're going to go to a 1 to 700 scale now, or because we've changed all these things. I just don't think you're going to ever see that. So I think we're going to stick with what we probably have. And as we know, the PDGA sells themselves that you get a rating. So that's another reason why it makes sense. People like to say, you know, people want to see that, you know, so-and-so shot a 1040 on this course. And if I go and I can kind of estimate, oh, look, I shot, you know, when I shot there with my friends, I shot a 1040 at this tournament. Like there's things because you won't get a rating any other way. You could try to compare it to with scores, but you've got different wind conditions and scenarios. If theirs is rainy versus not, and there's a whole lot of stuff that, I mean, again, it's just I've got no problem with the hot takes or the cold takes, whatever you want to call them, that any ratings takes. It's everyone's got an opinion and I think they're all valid. Not every opinion is valid.
I mean,
but the ones I've heard are so far.
I apologize. I occasionally see Brody. I think you said earlier in the chat that I missed the point. And if you want to just clarify what you think I missed, I do want to make sure that I understand what you're saying.
I don't know if he said you did or somebody else on our board.
I think at one point he said I did, but he said, why can't they just use scores? And in maybe I'm way off the mark here from understanding, but. So you're not concerned about from course to course. You're just saying we should only look at scores for an event, and that should be a good enough indicator of basically the skill level and the degree in which they shot. Please let me know if that's what you're trying to say. Because at that point,
that makes sense within an event.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. It's one indicator.
Yep.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, that's almost trying to negate any other reason for any other statistics than two, right? Couldn't we extrapolate that into saying, you know what? I don't give a crap who hit nine putts from circle two and who hit 18 putts from circle one at 27 feet. None of that matters. All that matters is the score. And that's just not, obviously at the end of the day, low score wins, but a rating, if you treat a rating like a lot of the other statistics that are out there, it just tells a little more of a story or gives some form of indicator of the play that was achieved. Just like if I told you, oh, wow, Simon Lazat this weekend for four rounds, which he didn't play, but Simon Lazat was 100% from C1, from C2, 100% from C2. Your ears would perk up. And then you'd want to think, well, okay, well, did he have 10 opportunities? Did he have nine opportunities? Was he 20 for 20 somehow from circle two? Or did he have one look from circle two and he happened to make that one look? Like, of course, just saying you're 100% doesn't give the whole story, but it gives some kind of indication of what was happening from circle two. And I feel like a rating gives some form of some indication of what was happening out there. Is it perfect? Absolutely not.
No, everyone agrees that it's flawed.
It will never make sense to all of us because it's like a lot of other scenarios out there. There's just too many variables.
I still don't understand a lot of advanced baseball statistics these days. If it's not batting average, RBIs, or home runs, I'm lost.
All right.
There's all sorts of sabermetrics.
I'll do my best here to just quickly catch up with you, Brody. I see you. You said, yeah, scores should be compared to scores on that course, which I think is how we create a leaderboard. I follow you, right? That's how the leaderboard is created. And then you said, what's more impressive, 10 under at Northwood or 10 under at Memorial? Obviously, a 10 under at Northwood, you could say is more impressive. I got that. I totally get that.
Seeing...
Can I call in for a sec?
Sure. You want to send them... You have the link you sent to Prez. It'll be the same thing. No. All I'm saying is that it's... A general and easy, like looking at the rating is a very, very simple and easy way to look at two rounds that are totally disparate, different right rounds, different courses, different environments, and say this person shot relatively the same as what this person did. And, you know, that's kind of a general idea because a flat score just doesn't say that. And you can say that that's not accurate. I don't think it's 100% accurate, but again, if this weekend Terry Miller shoots a 1050 rated round in DDO and I shoot a 1050 rated round in Standing Rocks, you could probably say, wow, they both had about the same good weekend, you know, but those scores might be significantly different because Standing Rocks is a way wooded course where the scores are probably going to be lower than what DDO is. For that type of thing. That's all I'm kind of getting at. I mean, I don't, obviously there's nothing crazy or silly about that, but no, we're always welcome if Brody wants to come on. I think Terry just messaged Brody in.
All right. I text you and
texted him the link.
Allegedly the past tense of text
is texted
is text.
Oh, it's text. Like I text you that.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
I know it sounds weird because none of us say it, but I heard that once. That's what I try and drill into my kids' heads.
Oh, no.
Past.
I know. I
tense.
I don't. I won't say it. I don't care what.
That's fine.
I don't think you.
See, now this says texted is correct. Somebody years ago said texted wasn't correct.
Oh, well, I mean.
I don't know. Let me check Urban Dictionary. I think the common pronunciation.
Are we going to have a video for Brody or no? Just curious.
I would assume so.
If not, that's fine. We can just bring him in via audio. Doesn't matter to me.
Oh, can we hear you? No. Hold on a sec. No, we cannot hear you at the moment. If you see him on the call thingy.
Let me open it up. I'll tell you. It says here. Oh, it's calling. Call connected just now. And
do you have a little camera button you press?
There he is. I see a hand. So he must have hit the camera button. It looks like it's just dark in your area.
Use the dark horse, dummy. This is branding.
This is
all branding.
Valid point. Oh, there we go.
All right. Hello.
All right. Here we go. We'll bring you on. We don't even need your video if you don't want there, Brody. We can just bring you on via audio.
I was going to say I'm in the darkness right now.
Yeah, it is. You are the dark horse, right?
This is getting weird.
Can we get a whinny? I don't know. Do you do that?
This is the best time to listen to you guys, just while you're lying in bed trying to go to sleep, you know?
I'm so sorry for Kelsey.
No, she's already in Vegas. I had to drop her off at 5 o'clock this morning. That's why I'm so exhausted.
So she's getting ready. She's getting ready for Raiders Nation. Is that the kind of the deal?
It was kind of crazy. Some stuff was going on in the organization. She thought she wasn't going to come back. Then all of a sudden yesterday, some stuff changed. And so she got on a flight this morning and is trying out right now. So kind of some crazy stuff is happening all of a sudden, but all good.
That's interesting that she has to try out again. I mean, she was obviously, you know, what are they considered? Raider girls?
Raiderettes.
Raiderette.
She was one last year, and that she has to try it again.
Everyone has to do it. Even if you're a captain, you have to try out. So it's just a fair way of making it so every girl has a chance, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
All right.
Explain. Just I want to make sure I'm obviously even on the same page with what you're trying to say. And then I may or may not agree. But
this was my whole point to begin with. And it all came from a tweet from someone asking me a question. And the tweet was basically saying, hey, Andrew Presnell averaged 10.41 or whatever it was. Did everyone just play bad? That is my biggest issue with ratings, is it's a very confusing thing for a lot of people coming into disc golf. If we're trying to make disc golf bigger and easier for people to come in and consume, the rating system isn't something that's used in any other sport. There's not really this arbitrary number that you can say like, oh, like this number shows how well this person played this week versus this person, or it shows this person played a tournament this and here and this. It's just a weird number, and I've already gone into great detail on like why it's bad. Like my best example with that is if we play a 400-foot hole, me and you, Terry, that hole is going to play exactly the same for me if there's a 380-foot water carry or if there's not a 380-foot water carry. And for someone, it might be drastically difficult for them based off their skill level. So sometimes these tournaments make it look like it's a lot harder when in fact it's not at all, just based on the players in the field. So I think we all can agree that the rating system is flawed in a way. And my only thing is, I don't think we ever need to use it. That's my big thing. I don't see when there's ever a point to use it. And what I was saying is that I think you were kind of getting I maybe wasn't explaining myself well, is like Isaac Robinson. I can go and look at Isaac Robinson's scores at last year's Champions Cup, and I can see how well he played. I can also go and look at Andrew Presnell's scores and see how well he played at Northwood. I don't need to look at, oh, Andrew Presnell shot 15 under and Isaac shot, what, 30 or whatever it was at. I'm not looking at those two. They're two different courses. I'm literally looking at, holy crap, Andrew Presnell won by 5 or 4 shots, whatever it was. Like, holy cow, he played really, really well.
Yeah, like,
I don't need to compare between tournaments like that.
Well, you don't, but somebody else may want to. And I think that the rating
But you can. You can with scores. Isaac Robinson won by 10. Andrew Presnell won by 5. Isaac Robinson played better. Like, it's right there for you.
But I get it, but that's where I feel like, and I understand what you're saying. I think I fully understand now. But I feel like then you're also essentially saying, hey, let's just start taking away – It's a stat.
No.
Let's just start taking away other stats. Like the Milwaukee Bucks lose to the Pacers.
The stats tell a story.
But the Milwaukee Bucks lose to the Pacers by 20.
Yes.
No, I'm just making stuff up.
They did.
But let's just say they did.
Yes.
And then again, someone would look and point to as to maybe why was it,
yes, of course.
Was it free throw attempts? Was it, you know, 3-point yeah. attempts? Was it, you yeah. know, rebounds, steals?
I'm all like, for
you're
those.
Looking for those stats. And if the rating, I feel like, is some reflection of a statistic. It's not the only one, because like I just said, if you could also, if you drill down, you look at Andrew Presnell and you'd be like, oh my God, that dude went 40 for 41 from C2 this weekend. Well, clearly that's, you know, was a factor in him winning.
Those are hard stats though, versus I think this
yeah,
rating.
Yeah, but Terry, looking algorithm. At his rating, if I'm looking at his rating, I'm saying, oh, well, everyone played bad and he just got lucky that he didn't have to play that good. Because Ricky didn't shoot 1060. Paul didn't shoot 1060. Oh, AB, who's been averaging 1065 at these tournaments that he's winning, AB played terrible. He only averaged 1030. So Andrew Presnell just got lucky that he played okay and everyone else played bad. That's what the ratings is telling you. And we all watched. That sure. is not what happened this week. Yeah. That is not. Ricky played phenomenal. Ricky sure. played incredible. AB played great. Presnell was just that good.
It's kind of funny thinking that I don't know one of the, as we say, the flaws in the rating is if everyone, imagine a scenario where everyone truly played bad. You've got people, everybody's missing C1 putts, like the whole field for whatever reason.
Emporia Country Club a couple years ago, my best finish ever.
Correct.
Because
it was so windy, the ratings would still, like, someone's still probably shooting a 1040, a 1050, even relatively if they clearly maybe shouldn't be, because you're comparing it against the rest of the field. I mean, again, I think they have a value. But,
so the, I guess, Mike, the, but here's...
The, oh, go ahead, Terry, sorry.
I was just going to say, so I fully understand. Your example makes perfect sense as to it seems weird that the top rating for this weekend, whatever Andrew averaged, 1040 or whatever it was mm-hmm. significantly lower than, I feel like it was just a couple weeks ago, you needed 1070 to win at Jonesboro. 1060 was the magic number that Kelvin
Heimer was shooting. Well, it's like 1020 to cash.
Yeah, and at Jonesboro, for the last 4 years, Kelvin took either first or second by shooting 1060, right? That was just how it worked out. And you're saying, here's a major with a bunch of the top players in the world, and Andrew won it with 1040. Does that diminish what everyone else's efforts were?
Correct.
So I understand you. I totally get it. Would you like to see players and media then just put less emphasis on ratings?
Yeah,
do you feel like that's yeah. essentially what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, again, like, I don't think the Disc Golf Pro Tour, whoever it was, the PDGA, I get it. The PDGA, that is, I think Johnny made a good point in saying that is right now their number one thing to get people to sign up is ratings.
Yeah,
that is their...
Yeah,
that is it, right? That's got to be their number one thing.
It ratings and then discounts for playing and being eligible to play in sanctioned events. I think it's the two of those.
Yeah, that's shifted recently. Yeah.
Are certainly some of their biggest benefits to being a member. I don't think that's a secret or anyone's pulling punches by saying that.
I also think ratings are good for amateurs. I think you need to have something to be able to classify where people are playing, whether it's flawed or not, you mm-hmm. got to have something.
Okay,
so you can't just have someone that is like, you know, now granted, I think the easiest way to correct this is how I would correct ratings is you literally drop all your low ratings. You only take your top 10 to 15%. That way you don't have sandbaggers. That way you can't have people that play bad on purpose to drop themselves. So they're constantly playing in MA2. It happens. I have tons of accounts of people saying that this person should not be in MA2. If you play 100 rounds and you take your top 10 rounds, you no longer. And also, here's the other thing, Terry. We all know people that can shoot 1025, but also can shoot 900. We also know people that are always going to shoot 940 to 960. They don't have a low floor. They don't have a high ceiling. Should those people both be competing? They're both 960 rated. Should those people both be competing in the same division? And the answer is no, because should someone in MA2 go to a tournament and shoot something that they would have won MPO? No, but we see that. I've had screenshots of people in MA1 and MA2 winning, would have had a winning score in MPO. And it's because they have such a low floor. To me, for the rating to make the most sense for AMs is it should be at, and this is what the handicap is in golf. And honestly, they should have just copied what golf did, but they want to do something different and, you know, pay this person a whole bunch of money, which we won't get into. But golf, it's literally your handicap. If you say, hey, I'm a scratch golfer, that doesn't mean every single time you go and play golf, you're going to shoot par. That means when you play well, you're going to shoot par. So Tara, your rating should be 10-20, because when you play well, you shoot 10-20. You shouldn't be playing with someone that when they play well, they shoot 980. You're in two different divisions. That's how I think you fix ratings for the AMs.
Possible.
I follow the logic. I think saying only
don't
to
like
take,
that idea.
I think that's too few in terms of your how many
What's
you
the
would take
to that.
Yeah, you're taking too few because that's.
What's the negative to that though?
Because if you can go out and shoot a 1,010 rated round, but mm-hmm. you only do that occasionally,
10% of the time.
I don't feel like that's where your skill level is. Like everybody can have a hot day, and if you then often shoot 940 golf or 930 golf or something like that, I just think it's a better representation of your actual average. Just like I would say, like in baseball, they don't just like magically throw out, well, okay, you get 10 free strikeouts per season and we're going to take those off your stats either. Like you're an average of every time you go to the plate. And
well, yeah. Again, you're comparing actual like statistics that we want to know versus what I'm saying is trying to fit people in the right skill division. And I think to fit people in the right skill division, it should be based off of when people play their best, not based off of average. Because again, the average, and I don't know if you guys get these stories either, but I get them every single time of sandbaggers, people that legitimately go out, they know they're not going to win. So instead of shooting a 980 rated round, they sandbag and shoot 920 and lower their rating so they don't move up. I've had countless people hit me up with that. That wouldn't happen ever. Also,
I would like to see how many people admit to that, because that I feel like
I don't think anyone's going to admit to doing that.
And I feel like, man, if you are built of that fiber and you're doing that all to hustle for an extra freaking t-shirt. Like, God, man, I'm staying in MA2 because next weekend I got a chance to win $47 fucking money dollars.
But some people just like to win.
Terry, 100% that's happening.
Some people just like to win, like they don't care.
Which is funny because I don't believe they're sandbagging in disc golf. There's rating threshold. There's people that play. Usually when you're talking about all these lower divisions, their scoring and their results are just that much more volatile. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And we're taking away their lowest. That's whatever outside of the standard deviation, blah, blah, blah. We're taking away their lowest. And then you're double weighting their most recent. Like, I don't know. I
could see
people are hustling to get themselves an extra $27.
I think those people exist out there. I don't think they're a majority. I don't think there's a lot of them. But and I will say I could see an argument for divisions as far as maybe changing rating as far as like look at I'll take the perfect example. What I think is for MP40 is 920 and higher for MP40. Like I'm a 920. Now, thankfully, I'm a 920 rated player. I could play in a lot of other divisions. I could play in amateur. I could play in advanced. I could play but say I really wanted to play in an age protected division. I'm not a pro caliber player right now. I think should I be forced to play in a pro division, an age protected pro division? Like, is 920 the right number? I could see some arguments. Me personally, I don't care. I'm not out there to, like, if I took bottom cash or less than bottom cash, as we said earlier, I don't care. My goal is like 920 might not be the right number. I think there could be some adjustment for divisions, but it's 100% arbitrary.
The cutoff lines are arbitrary. Here, let me ask, and I've just thought of this, so tell me how this strikes you, Brody. Away. If you're talking about looking at basically players at their best, and maybe this is a terrible analogy, but does the high school or college basketball player that hits 99 out of 100 threes and makes 98% of their free throws for a season?
Amazing.
we're taking their skills clearly prove they can perform all of this activity. Does that automatically mean that they belong in the NBA? Like they've shown these skills and they're performing at this top level.
No, that's like saying someone makes every single putt inside. And there's the other reason why I think ratings are stupid is I play with a guy that on certain courses is 1,010, 1,015 rated golfer. But if you took him and he played the pro courses, he would shoot probably 920. That's also a reason why ratings are dumb. Because he can't throw far. So if you put him on a technical short course, he's one of the best putters I've ever seen. You put him on a technical short course, he can get inside a circle two almost every time. Mm-hmm. And he's going to shoot great rated rounds. You put him on a course, he's never going to get a birdie on the pro level.
Sure.
That was my other hot take is I think if we really want to get super crazy, let's do two ratings. Let's do an O rating and that's for open, and let's do a W rating for Woods. That's a super hot take.
Well, and this is where I told you I talked to Chuck Kennedy and he was talking about a standardized course, as in the same number of par threes, same number of par fours, and the same number of par fives for most of the pro tour events. You know, right now, mm-hmm. you know, Ledgestone has two par six, arguably, and a par five, depending on how you want to look at it. Only having one par five, because that's how golf does it. Clearly, as you know, 71, 72, you have a specific number of par threes, specific number of par fours, a specific mm-hmm. number of do they even have par fives? Yeah, they have par fives in golf.
Yeah, they have four par fives, four par threes, and then 12 par fours.
And I know there's talk with Jeff Spring about some of this, and this is all future stuff about whether or not, you know, should the PDGA be involved in this? Is this a pro tour thing? Should we start to get more standardized courses and then find a ways to tweak them versus, you know, you don't necessarily need X amount of open holes, but at least try to figure out what the correct par is. It's like, and then that would make ratings a little more.
Yeah, the most challenging thing with disc golf is even with golf, like if you go and play what I would consider an easy golf course, mm-hmm. if you're not good at golf, that easy golf course is still pretty challenging. If you go and play a hard golf course and you're not good at golf, that course is very hard. With disc golf, we have such a super vast change. You look at a course like Jonesboro. Jonesboro is a super scoreable course. You look at Emporia Country Club. I know they're making some changes for Champions Landing, but without wind, that course is super scoreable. And then you go to like a Northwood, that course is way harder. So it's vastly different. The other thing in golf too is if I'm a scratch golfer, if I go to one course, my best score or what my, like if I'm playing well, might be a 70. And then if I go to a different course, my best score there might be a 78. So depending on the course in golf, your handicap also changes from course to course as well. And that is based with a lot of information mm-hmm. from thousands and thousands and thousands of data points of players. We just don't have that in disc golf. And that's why I think the ratings are kind of really at the end of the day, kind of pointless. And that's why I think the best way of us doing it is literally stop, like, and again, this is just the pro tour, this is just the PDGA. Stop talking about players' ratings. Stop saying that Andrew Presnell is the lowest rated player ever to win a major. Like, stop saying all that stuff. I don't care. There's other things I think we have right now that's better. Like, to me, a better stat is Andrew Presnell's never finished in the top 10 at a major, and then he just somehow figured out how to win.
Yeah, those are better storylines.
that shows how crazy of a win it was.
I think the downside in the Gulf scenario is that maybe the ratings actually benefit is taking into account things like weather. Because as you said, if you go to a golf course and you're normally 70,
I know so.
You're doing 30 to 40 mile an hour winds.
No, because again, the handicap is only taking your best scores. So if I go out and it's 30 miles per hour and I shoot 105, that score doesn't account towards my handicap. So it doesn't matter.
It doesn't count towards your handicap.
Your handicap does not account for weather.
Correct. But let's talk PGA, though. Like, again, if you look at someone at Augusta one year who shoots, you know, 8 under, and you know, next
this is then, my Emporia Country
like,
Club
like
example,
2 over, exactly. I think our ratings take into account weather, whereas a PGA doesn't, and they don't necessarily have to.
You don't need to, though.
Exactly, because the consistency like of their courses.
You go and you look at Emporia Country Club, and you look, and I shot the final round. I shot 1 under or whatever it was. If you compare that to other years, you're going to be like, oh, Brody played terrible. What the heck? But if you compare it to that day, there was 4 people or 5 people that shot under par. And there were people that are shooting 8, 9, 10 under over par. So if you wanted to, you could literally be like, oh, what happened that day? Or you could literally just be like, oh, I guess it was super windy. Because any logical person would look at scores and be like, oh, the day before, the average score was 10 under par. And today the average score was even par.
I think
people didn't just play bad. A bunch of people just didn't play bad that day. The conditions were harder.
And I know we're going round and round,
but you need a rating to tell you that.
I think what the rating makes it easy to do is display that in a graphic rather than having to tell a story. If you say last year, Brody Smith shot a 1040, this year he shot a 1030, you can easily say, oh, he shot worse this year. It doesn't matter about the weather. You don't have to think, how did the rest of the course shoot? Okay. How did, you know, that is why, I think the ratings make it an easier story to tell for a quick snapshot between different things. That's, you know, and I know we're going round and round in circles.
Why wouldn't you just say, instead of saying that, why wouldn't you just say last year Brody got third place, this year he got 30th? That tells a way better story.
It could, but I mean, again, it could also
a way better story.
You might have taken fifth place both years with a 1050 one year and a 1040 the next year. You may still. So I think that it's easier. Again, the rating just makes it an easier story for.
See, I disagree. I think it makes it way more confusing.
For people,
your point right there.
What the ratings are, sure.
If I took fifth place both years, and one rating was one, and one rating was what another, like the ratings weren't the same from year to year, but I took fifth place both years, I don't really. I don't really care about the rating.
Correct. You don't care about the rating. But again, there are people from the outside that, you know, fans and stuff like that that maybe want to see
both years.
Did Brody shoot better this year?
But couldn't you say the same?
He shot the same. He got fifth place both years. He shot the same. He finished the same.
Relative to the field,
is based off of the people we're playing against. Like that's at the end of the day, that's what you're trying to beat people.
Yeah, the ratings are too. Yeah.
So you'd be okay with, or you're suggesting that we just basically don't emphasize what ratings were for an individual round or event or person or average or anything of that nature. You're essentially the entire crux of your argument and your point is they just don't matter because they're too flawed.
Because right now, Terry, if I asked you what was one of the best rounds of the year so far, what would you say on the tour?
Gosh, my memory is so bad.
Because right now, are you trying to think of ratings? Are you trying to think of someone that popped off a high rated round?
I'm running through winners in my head right now.
I guess I haven't been involved in every event. I immediately naturally think of Barella, who wasn't even on the tour because it was the Memorial. I think of him shooting, 17 under at Fountain Hills as just an incredible round.
Sure. Not on
and,
tour.
And 17 so under is impressive. Pass. And whatever it was rated, which I think was 1,100 and something, wasn't even my concern. Just, you're right, a raw score.
Do you have anything on tour? Do you have anything on tour that jumps out at you as a really good round?
Funny, what have I broadcast?
I can't think of any crazy rounds that we've seen on tour.
Chess.com, I can't think of any. Waco's, nothing jumps out. It's kind of funny. What was the best round of the year so far?
I'll give you a hint. Happened really recently, like a couple days ago.
I mean, Casey White's 7, right?
Someone did better. See, and that's the problem, is that wasn't highly rated, so no one's talking about it. No one remembers it. Ezra Aderholt shot 10 under par, 10 birdies, 2 bogeys, shot 8 under at Northwood. Mm-hmm. You had Casey who shot 7. After that, it drops off drastically. That 8 under is no one was Matty O was kind of sniffing it the mm-hmm. final round, able to pull it off. That 8 under is the most impressive round we've had this season. 8 under at Northwood is insane.
Yeah, it's rated 1063 right now.
But so no Brody's one's
point
about
is
it.
That it
yeah.
that 1063 doesn't sound impressive compared to the correct. 17 under by Barella at Fountain. And I understand
if AB played 100 rounds at Memorial at Fountain Hills and played 100 rounds at Northwood, I don't know if he ever shoots 8 under at Northwood. I bet he shoots 17 under multiple times.
But I mean,
probably actually in the teens at Memorial. That's the whole reason why ratings don't work.
Sure.
8 under at Northwood is insane.
Yeah, but again, as you said, people would have to do research in order to find out. Like, if you just told me someone shot an 8 under, I'm like, okay, whatever. They shot 8 under.
Yeah, you have to say what the course is.
Agree.
You have to tell them what the course is.
But even the course, as you said, people that are uninformed, you could tell someone I shot 8 under at Northwood, and they're like,
cool. Blue,
they're going to ask if they don't know what Northwood is. They're going to say, is that good?
Yeah, and you're going to say,
it was the course record. Mm-hmm. It was the best round ever shot there.
Yeah.
And no, now all of a sudden I have context.
Of course. But again, that to me, as a broadcaster, that is a story that's going to be a lot more difficult to explain in a graphic. Like, because I need something. And again, I'm not saying ratings are necessarily right, but getting that point across to somebody in 3 seconds is difficult. But then again, we don't always.
What if you did this in a graphic? Ezra Aderholt, 8 under, average score, mm-hmm. 2.6 over par was the average score on that course. What if you did that? Ezra Aderholt, 8 under, average score, two and a half
yeah,
strokes over par.
That tells a story.
That tells
it
a lot.
It does. Yeah.
Oh, here's another one. Ezra Aderholt, previous day, 7 over par. Today, 8 under. That tells a story too.
Someone would then say, "Is it fluky?"
Yeah, exactly. What happened?
Well, it just shows you that course is that. Like, if AB plays Fountain Hills, he's shooting 12 under to 17 under. That's his range.
Yeah,
I don't think AB's going out to Fountain Hills and shooting 4 under, unless someone chops off his arm.
Yeah, or it gets crazy windy for some crazy reason. But
and like that's the other thing too. If I told you guys, hey, all you have to do to be a major champion is shoot 4 under at Northwood every day, you'd be like, oh, okay, that's pretty feasible. No one did it.
No,
not a single person did it.
Coincidentally, you're right. Not 4 under as an average, but I think I saw another stat or a friend text me and said Andrew was the only player to shoot under par all 4 rounds.
There you go. That's another fantastic. See, to me, like that's another fantastic stat.
Yeah, that's
bad. That tells me way much more than he shot 1040 rated. And I'm like, oh, he didn't even play that well.
Mm-hmm.
No, he played really well. There was only one person in the field I didn't even know that. That's an incredible stat. Like to me,
I think
throw that on a graphic. Get rid of this 1040 crap.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, to your point, when I'm in the middle of doing FPO and I had witnessed and experienced watching Kristen destroy the last 4 holes of the round
day after day.
Day one, she did it day two, she did it day three.
Oh, when she got like 8 strokes or something.
Yeah. I'm, you know, we message Stat Mando and say, what is she under par on, you know, the last 5 holes of the course? And she's blank and the rest of the field was blank. I think we actually created a stat that said just that.
Love that.
And put it up on the graphic. So I am not disputing what you're saying at all in terms of raw score. obviously is yet another tool and a resource for us to point at. And that's exactly what we did. And it was funny because it was my idea that I had text Mo in the middle of the show. We'll pat myself on the back for that. But watching her, what she had done on those last few holes was obviously really impressive compared to everyone else. You know, and we kind of similarly did that even as we were closing out with, you know, the MPO this weekend, which is what the best score was on the back nine or the back eight or nine holes. And it was four under. And, you know, trying to, and only a couple people had achieved that. So just basically talking about how difficult the back nine plays. And at no point would we ever been like, hey, you need to average, you know, 1,040 on the back nine. I mean, of course, we're not going to say that. So to your point, there's nothing wrong with using raw scores. I guess I look at ratings in this sense as it is another thing to look at. And I think you're saying, let's just look at it less and put less weight on it, if any.
Yeah, I think it tries to tell the same story as scores. It just is worse. So in my opinion, it's not like you're talking about C2 percentage, fairway percentage, how many times they throw OB. That tells a completely different story, right? Like knowing that there was only three people in the field that took bogey or better, or like that never took a double bogey or worse. Like that tells something that a rating can't tell me. That also tells me something that a score can't tell me. So like, I still want all those statistics. And I think you guys did a phenomenal job at the end of Sunday with MPO, with all those stats you guys were providing. I thought that was phenomenal, especially when you start thinking about, all right, can he actually shoot the best round on the back nine to actually put himself in a position? I love all that. I just literally think the ratings give you absolutely nothing. And the only thing it gives you is confusion. And then it gives people the idea of someone played way better than they actually did. And some people played not as good when they actually played really good.
Sure.
And this whole idea too, like that's the other thing. Do we think Paul Macbeth is worse at disc golf? Do we think Ricky is worse at disc golf? Do we think Calvin is worse at disc golf? Well, the ratings would show that they are, right? Because they've dropped their ratings. But I don't think they are. I think they still are phenomenal players. And so that's where it's like, it's used right now too in a lot of manufacturers and their sponsorships, which I think is lame. It's used to sign up for tournaments. I think that's lame. I think it's used because we can go in a whole different like backstory kind of, because right now, obviously we were just talking about graphics. I think it's used way more than we actually are really giving on. And I don't think it's a good assessment of skill level.
I don't mind it for registration, honestly, assuming we're talking, not talking pro tour. I think the pro tour, you've got tour card holders.
No, we're talking pro tour. I'm always talking pro tour.
I assume as much.
Yeah.
The tour card holders always get first dibs. That's the way it goes. And then it goes based on, you know, obviously ratings based. So the, in theory, our higher rated players will get the advantage to sign up over.
Yeah, I think there should be like more qualifiers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think there are good people that aren't being able to get into events. And I don't think that's really fair. Because like you said, you can massage your rating.
You can, yeah. You said yourself, I think when you were first coming in the sport, you talked to, what is it, Felberg or whomever about ways to boost your rating quicker based on the people you play with, the events you play, the type of courses you play.
The third highest rated player in the world one time was this one guy in Texas that played a local C tier event.
He played one event,
He played one event. Luke Humphreys was there. Emerson Keith was there. I don't know what they were doing, but they both played terrible. And he was 1048 rated or something. And so he didn't play another event. And he is the third best player off the ratings in the world.
I mean, like
that stuff makes no sense.
For that, you're taking a small statistical thing. You could say that about, you know, at the beginning of the season, if a baseball player goes, you know, hits a home run, a triple, and a double, or two doubles, they're batting 1,000. You could be like, he's the best batter in the league. And you're like, that's a small sample. Though. That's a small sample size.
Johnny, he is, though.
No, he's not.
At that moment, he is the best batter.
Well, then should one game, you know, qualify him for saying that?
No, but if you were saying, let's go to basketball. If one game happens in basketball, everyone plays one game in basketball and someone scores 60 points and you ask who's the leading scorer in the NBA after one game, it's that guy. That's statistics.
Sure. But if you asked who's the best shooter, is it that guy?
Well, I don't know. What did he shoot? What was his percentages? You'd have to look at those numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying those are legitimate statistics of where you can't, if someone's 99 of 100 after a couple games in the NBA for the free throw line and you ask who's the best free throw shooter, it's him. That's what we do with putting. Yeah, but that's what we do with all our statistics. The ratings things, no one's saying that this guy's the third best player in the world because we know ratings are flawed and he isn't. Look at Matt Manabu. That's the perfect example. He was the highest rated player in the world. Does anyone think he actually is the best player in the world? No. Does that make any sense? No. Like the highest rated player, if ratings actually made sense, the highest rated player should be the best player in the world. And he came over to the United States and I think what was his best finish? Like 90th?
No, it was higher than that. But
oh, like 100th? You're saying higher than
that? No. I think it was better than that.
So should we?
But you see what my point is?
I see your point.
No, of course.
This is a tangent to what you're saying, and I totally follow what you're saying. Should we care or then celebrate something like Kristen potentially getting to 1,000? Or
that's such a tough one.
Because, or should we just disregard it because
you're right. This is essentially
saying that the ratings are flawed and they're goofy and massage. And I can understand all that. Should we not celebrate something like that? Or even 999, pick a number. I don't care. She's the highest rated woman in the world. Should we not even recognize that feat of her being the highest rated woman in the world? Because if ratings are flawed and weird and goofy, then you're essentially saying we should not even recognize them by anyone ever.
In a perfect world, I think the answer is yes. Like when she hits 1,000 rated, we should not make a big deal about it.
Okay.
But I know for a fact that's not going to be the case. What I would love to see happen is just some dark horse person in Europe or something come over and play Memorial and do one round at Memorial and shoot 1,005. And now that person's the first ever 1,000 rated FPO player ever. And so then we're like, well, this is kind of stupid. Like they're clearly not as good as Chris Tatar. That would be a dream situation for me. So then it would just be done because
drive your point home. I follow.
I'm not going to be an idiot. Yeah. I'm not going to be an idiot and be like, oh, if she hits 1,000, I'm not going to talk about it. Right. Like that would be silly of me to say. But it does put me in a pickle for sure. Because
you better not praise the best woman in the world or we're going to get shit.
I know.
I think there's two ways to look at it. There's the marketing way.
Because FPO ratings are also inflated by like 20 or 30 points.
Oh, okay. I'm
not going there, but.
Well, just go. If you don't believe me, go to any course where the FPO rate, the FPO played the same layout in the MPO, and you can compare the two ratings between the two. You can also go and look at courses where the FPO is playing shorter baskets, the FPO is playing shorter tees, and the difference in rating versus difference in scores between the FPO and MPO don't match up.
I could see that they're not the same. Yeah.
No. Well, like a 1,000 rated, let's say, is like 10 under, but 10 under is 980 rated for MPO, and MPO is playing a much harder layout. That makes no sense.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. You can literally go to tournaments and see that for yourself. European Open also. Was a good indicator when I was like fascinated with ratings and trying to learn everything. You can go and look and see when they play the same course layout, how it doesn't match up. Because again, it's just based off Chris Tatar.
Yeah.
It's so much better than the bottom part of the field. So the bottom part of the field makes the course look a lot harder than it actually is.
Yeah. I will say that when you could talk about course pars, you can talk about a lot of things that the bottom portion of our field, I'm okay if we put a ratings floor on some of our bigger events. Like just say you can't play unless you're at least this, like no exceptions.
Oh. I think that would be nice.
I think for all of us too, for pay-to-play issues.
970 rated players into the pro tour, because if they don't fill up, I think it's 970
or 975.
They're raising it every year though, right? I think every year they're raising it.
And you and I talked about this on the podcast, saying that like ratings hopefully will become more and more accurate as we get rid of some of the bottom and we start. These players stop playing B tiers because they don't need to. So they're only focused on the toughest courses, and we will get there. As far as KT goes, Kristen Tatar, I think her 1,000 rated is easy to celebrate, especially for the PDGA. Because the PDGA is, you know, and of course her sponsors and whatnot will push that, because as we know, the PDGA is selling ratings, which they should be. It's, you know, they want to do
money maker.
I mean, does it in theory, does it matter to the pro tour at all? No, not really. Like it, I'm not saying it shouldn't, but it doesn't. You know, the pro tour doesn't matter. It doesn't care if she's 850 and winning every event, or if she's 990 winning every event. They will celebrate it. They'll talk about it. It'll be a talking point. But that's, you know, we all know that is just how it's going to be.
It just goes back to, like, because the floor has been raised year after year, that's why these guys can't hold the high ratings anymore. I mean, that's why Andrew Presnell just won at a 1040 rated round, right? Like, imagine back when Paul McBeth was over 1050 rated, he wins Champions Cup and his rating goes down, right? Like, that's a crazy thing to think about. And again, I don't want people using ratings and looking at like, oh, like this person was only 1040 rated like 10 years ago, this person was 1050. Well, look at where the cash line is, right? The cash line's going up and up and up and up every year of like what you have to shoot to be able to cash. So
see, and I just don't think
it's great comparing from era to era, because in 2015, a 1050 rated round is not equivalent to a 1050. It should be. That's the thing. A 1050 rated round in 2015 should be exactly the same as in 2024. It is not. It's probably 15 to 20 points off.
Yeah, Eric, only because this is in my personal favor, do I share this? Eric McCabe famously said that when I was rated 995 back in 2007, as he said, he's like, I feel like this. He said this a couple of years ago when we were doing a podcast. He's like, I feel like with ratings inflation, that was probably closer to like a present day 1010 or 1015. And to your point, yeah, Kenny Climo wasn't probably shooting the rounds he was and winning worlds with a 1013 average rating compared to what his exact same scores would look like today. And they would be rated higher, so to speak.
The equipment has changed.
And the equipment has changed, and the courses have changed, and there's a lot of factors to that. So, I mean, I'm feeding into your point, certainly, Brody, that...
But the equipment shouldn't also have an impact, Johnny.
On
ratings.
Climo won his first couple of world titles with Cobras and Vipers.
But so. if ratings are legit and everyone's playing with the same equipment, it shouldn't matter, because it's going off of those people you're playing against.
But it's also going against you'll have to agree. You should really reach out to Chuck Kennedy
I know the whole SSA thing.
Talking about OB, when Kenny played, there was hardly any OB. Like, they just, it didn't, average.
That's why Memorial has the best ratings. Cause again, that goes back to my point. And Anthony Barella steps up to hole one and is not terrified of that shot. Me and you two are terrified of that shot.
Yeah.
If me and you two are in that field, that makes AB look like that shot is really hard. If me and you two aren't in that field and it's a whole bunch of ABs, that shot's not that impressive anymore. So that's my whole thing with ratings, is like, it makes absolutely no sense. Like, if we all are throwing Cobras, then the ratings should be equipped. Like, it shouldn't. And that's why, like, USDGC, they can't do ratings out there, because the OB, it just is all a bunch of mess. It's a big mess. We're better off without them.
All right.
But I always love talking about it. It's always fascinating.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, but that tweet just got me going again. So I had to throw it on there. And to all the people out there too, let me explain it again. The 1,000 rated zone, that was like an inside thing with me and all my followers, because there was a bunch of people when I started playing disc golf that said I'd never be 1,000 rated. And I said, ratings are dumb. And they're like, well, that's because you'll never be 1,000 rated. So once I hit 1,000 rated, I said, we're doing a disc to celebrate all these naysayers. And then I'm never doing another disc with ratings. And you can go and look at all my products, all my hats, everything like that. I've never done another rating. I've never sold anything with ratings ever again since that. So that's that.
I know that story, and I'm all good with it. I've never second guessed that.
I know. It's just always funny when someone's like, "Wait, didn't 4 years ago? Didn't you make 1,000 rated zone?"
Yeah, so, I don't know, Brody.
But no, it's always good talking disc golf with you guys. It's always fun time.
I know you've heard the joke, but if you get to 1,000 again, you should re-release them.
That is funny. Yeah, definitely headed that way. That's for sure.
You said you're practicing now that you weren't really practicing earlier in the season, and hopefully.
Yeah, it's crazy how practicing actually gets you better at something.
Practice.
I thought disc golf was like riding a bike. You know, I would just be able to go back out there and know how to do it. It's not the case. Also, Northwood's kind of a dark horse course to come back to.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that with Eagle.
Yeah, Eagle. He knows all too well.
Yeah.
I understand. I won't say that I disagree with your take overall from a media perspective, especially maybe from a media perspective of the emphasis that we all put on ratings. So I can totally follow where you're going with all of that. It is certainly just at face value weird to see a Champions Cup winner average 10.41 or whatever it was this weekend.
Yeah.
Average 10.41 when we know that a couple weeks ago in Jonesboro, the average that won it was 10.60.
Yeah, it's been like 10.50 or above.
I was going to say, does 10.40 even get you a top 10 at Jonesboro?
I don't know. But
it might not even get you a top 10.
I completely understand what you're saying with that. And I guess it's an interesting thing to think about. Maybe I'm not as opposed to them as you are, in the sense that I think it is one possible snapshot of one thing that you factor in when you're telling an overall story. But I would agree that it shouldn't be exclusively the story. And I understand you'd love to eliminate it entirely. And I understand that. I'm good with that. I look at it as one potential. If I'm telling a story about a weekend, I may rattle off five things in which rating is one of those things. And
sure.
Maybe that's a better way to look at it, or maybe it becomes one of 10 things, or it's only, you know, half of one of five things that I meant, 0.5 of five or whatever, putting less emphasis on it. So I follow what you're saying.
One final question. Mm-hmm. One final question. What tells the story better? Andrew Presnell shot 15 under, won the tournament, second place shot 11 under. Or Andrew Presnell averaged 10.42, won the tournament, second place averaged 10.20 and won the tournament.
You second place won, or averaged 10.20 and took second place, not one. But yeah, I got it.
Or took second place.
I think
if you were telling someone about what happened at Champions Cup, which one would be better?
I don't want this to sound like a cop out, because I'm sure somebody could say that. But what I would say to that is, I think it depends on your audience. If I'm telling my dad, who doesn't give a rip about disc golf or know anything about it, I would tell him the scores. If I'm talking to my buddies that I play league with, who are familiar with like mm-hmm. the tour and such, I may then instead lead with, I would for almost for sure lead with the ratings version of that, as opposed to the raw score version of that. So for me, to answer that exact question, it would for me depend on the audience in which I'm talking to probably influence it. Right.
Secondary question. I think Johnny just said that, you know, your ceiling is 10.20, right? Is that what I think we said? something like that.
Yeah.
Who is okay,
let's just say yours right now. Like, it wouldn't shock me if you went out to a course and shot a 10-20 right around and followed it up with a 9-20 right around.
Yeah, I mean, I could come off the course tomorrow using somebody else's disc and go shoot a 10-20 accidentally.
Sure.
Yeah.
So if I'm your buddies and you told me that, am I thinking, oh, dang, Terry, you could have gotten second place at a major? See how that's kind of weird? Because like I'm like, wait, no, I've seen Terry shoot 10-20 before. Dang, Terry, you could have gotten second place there. Versus 11 under.
Well,
at Northwood, second place. Now I don't have this idea of like, wait, I can go out to my local pitch and putt and shoot 10-20. I can go all these 200-foot holes. I can birdie 16 of 18 of them. I've done that before. They're 200 feet. I've shot 10-20 before. Oh, I can do that. You see how it compares pitch and putt 10-20 versus the hardest course that we've ever played 10-20? And like that's the problem is the comparison doesn't match up.
And that's why Terry
gives a wrong story.
Talking about the audience.
I get what you're saying though, but I also feel like just because there's a pitch and putt and a scoreable course doesn't mean that people can get necessarily can go out and shoot those. And here's the only reason why I say that is I used to run a tournament in Wisconsin in Beaver Dam, and it was called the Leave It to Beaver. I know, clever. You would shoot 9 under and it was sub 1,000, or you'd shoot a 13 under and it still wasn't 1,000. That has to do with the SSA and a bunch of other math I don't understand. But my point is the raw score was not nearly as relevant when it came to the ratings. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you could shoot 13 under, and if it was rated 978, it just wasn't possible. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It wasn't possible to go shoot a 10-20, or I think I even looked at one time, like, if I would have entered in an 18 under, you know, it would have maxed out at, like, 10.54.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, which is also crazy.
Because I think the score separation for this particular event at Champions Cup was, like, I think Chuck had told me it was just under five points a stroke. And I looked and I was like, cool. So if Casey White, in theory, would have shot a perfect round, 18 under par, it would have topped out at about 1,100, little over, like 1,110.
Yeah, which is insane.
Which agreed. And that's what I said. That's where people see flaws. I even told Chuck, that's where people see flaws, because we all know if someone came out and shot an 18 under on this course, it would be the greatest round ever thrown, period. Better than Paul's 45 at Maple, better than, you know, his perfect round at D-Glow, better than Kenny's 23 of 24 birdies on whatever course that was. Like, we all know this would be 18, but ratings wise, it wouldn't show that. It would show like in a 1,015 or 1,000. I'm sorry, 11.
Ooh, I found it. Leave It to Beaver. I shot a 14 under and it was rated 10-19.
Yeah, so your buddy would literally say, "Yo, Terry, you could have gotten second at Champions Cup."
But
and we all know
that's
Terry,
a different
I love
time.
You. We all know you're not shooting 11 under through four rounds at Northwood.
Of course, but also similarly to your point,
buddy,
though.
But your buddy might say you could.
No, but to kind of go back on your point, they would say, "Wow, you shot 14 under? Man, you go shoot 14 under at Northwood, and I bet you're going to do pretty well. I've seen you shoot 14 under." So that's where, like, you're just saying scores.
It's all context. It's all context.
Terry, those courses are different.
I don't know. This course was pretty.
Terry, you're answering my point. Your 10-19 course that you shot 14 under, that should translate perfectly over to Northwood at what a 10-20 would be out there, which I guess would be three under par.
This was what, 8 years ago?
It wouldn't.
Oh, no. Again, this is 14
ratings
years
shouldn't
ago.
Matter. Ratings shouldn't matter 8 years ago and now.
No, that's what I'm
saying. In my prime,
in Terry's prime,
in my prime, when I played this good at this event, I might have been able to shoot a 2 under at Northwood. Like, that's not crazy.
Yeah. No, definitely.
So
yeah,
okay. I don't know.
Yes.
At any rate,
that's my only thing is, like, at the end of the day, people have to realize these courses are different, obviously, but we can all agree. You can go to your pitch and putt and shoot 1,000 under or shoot 1,000 rated and not be very good at disc golf.
Yeah. Yeah. You could definitely,
good 300 foot backhand, if you have a good 300 foot backhand and you can putt well, you can go to local courses and shoot 1,000 rated.
If you have a good 300
foot. If you go to the pro tour you're not going to shoot 1,000 rated if that is your skill set. 300 feet.
You will at Northwood. Well. You will at Northwood. If you have a three, if you have an accurate 300 foot, if you throw 300 foot down every fairway, and
where you want to,
and throw another 300 feet, and throw like you will get a few birdies, and you will take almost no bogeys out there. If assuming you're throwing 300 feet,
yeah, dead accurate,
At Northwood, I mean, Northwood specific. That's actually a course where you could, Terry could literally go out there and cash.
Like pick it apart.
Yeah, pick it. You could pick it apart because we know that Northwood is different as far as
push. You say that, but like the top players in the world aren't able to do that. So
agreed.
It's because they're throwing too far.
Yeah, because
I played a landing.
That's right.
I played a shorter landing zones.
That's right. I mean,
they got to do the Presnell.
Got to
exactly.
You do the Presnell and don't press. And yeah, we know it. So
still throwing 400 feet on a lot of those holes too.
I much understand and appreciate what you're getting at.
A good back and forth.
I'm not really even disagreeing at all. Just to put it out there, I'll go on record again. I am okay with the rating system. They are not the end all be all. They are a snapshot to give some people some idea of where things are at. I don't think they're so insanely flawed that that if a 9-10 rated player goes out and plays golf with a 10-20 rated player, like more often than not, obviously that 10-20 player is going to dominate the 9-10 rated player. Like it gives a snapshot of general, I'll say averages. I know that on average, if I'm rated 950 and you're rated 1,000, that if we went out and played 10 rounds together at most courses, you on average roughly will beat me by 5 strokes per round. Sometimes it's going to be 2, sometimes it's going to be 7, and one of those times I'll beat you, but the average would be in a 50-point deficit, if we played 10 rounds together, you're going to beat me on average by 5 strokes per round. And I'm okay with those very generic statements. I'm also not, you know, going out and standing in front of traffic and saying, you know, these are perfect.
But imagine if we only took our best scores, Terry, that might be even a closer battle.
No, see, I don't feel like that's representative of who I am then. Right. Because
if I was playing you for money, I would not want to go off of your average and say, hey, this is my average score. This is your average score. This is how many strokes I should give you. I would want to go off of what, my high ceiling is. Cause if your average, cause again, we've all seen, like, I'll give a shout out to John Nicholson. John Nicholson, mm-hmm. good friend of mine, was touring for a while. John Nicholson had one of the highest floors on tour and one of the lowest ceilings on tour. He was never going to shoot 1050. He was never going to really shoot below 1,000. He was going to be right around that 1,005. He's a perfect example. Shoot, you know, he's a little bit more consistent now. But in the past, we would see him shoot 1,080 and we would see him shoot 950, right? And so he has a massive, massive window. To me, showing like the top part, maybe it's not 10%, maybe it's 20% of your boards, or maybe it's 30%. We can, you know, finagle it however we want. But if we just did our top ceiling, so now I know, okay, Terry, when you play really, really well, you're going to shoot 2 on this course. When I play really, really well, I'm going to shoot 4 under on this course. I'm going to give you 2 shots, Terry. Let's go.
Yeah.
So now it's like, if we both play well, because that's ideally what you want to do. And that's exactly what golf does. Golf literally does. If you play well, this is your handicap. And yeah, if you go out there and you play bad, you're going to get smoked. But I mean, you're going to get smoked anyways, even if it's your average.
If your rating is essentially an average of how you play for the most part, I guess I'd look at, like, I don't know, make up another thing, like a bowling. Like you don't drop your lowest when you're creating your average, right? You bowl every week.
What do you mean about bowling?
What's that?
What are you talking about with bowling?
Just like with bowling, to get your bowling average, you bowl 10 weeks and that's your average, or 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it is. Like your bowling average fluctuates by sure. what you bowl every week. And sure. It's not, you're not just going to go and say, well, I played 10 weeks and my highest game was 280. Therefore I'm a 280 bowler. Like
I'm not arguing what the average is, but you could have two people bowl and their average both be 200, but one of them can bowl 300 and the only one has ever bowled a 220 as their highest. Like those two people shouldn't be in the same division.
Hmm.
That's my argument. The guy that can bowl 300 shouldn't be in the same division, even though their averages are the same. The one guy literally can only bowl 220. He's bowling 180 to 220 every single time. And the other guy's bowling 300. And then sometimes he has 100 because he's just chaotic. He's full press all the time or whatever you want to make the example. Like that's an extreme example, but that happens in disc golf. We know
so
that happens.
Using that logic, if I understand you correctly, would that be saying that Andrew Presnell should not be playing against Calvin and Paul and Ricky?
Because he's in the top echelon of the top echelon of ratings. Like he's in the top echelon of skill level.
Okay.
This more is like again like what's
but
that
isn't Ricky's Johnny, ceiling so much higher?
What's that?
Would you say Ricky's ceiling is so much higher than Andrew's? Like if you said, hey, 1,000%. Who's going to go out and shoot a 16 under at Northwood Black? And it's
Terry. I don't think anyone thinks that.
I'm just saying anyone thinks. But if you said somebody could
is higher than Ricky.
You don't think his ceiling isn't or is?
I don't think anyone would tell you that Andrew Presnell's ceiling is higher than Ricky. I don't think Andrew Presnell would even tell you his ceiling was higher than Ricky. When Ricky is playing at the top level, he's one of the best players in the world. I don't think. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I would put him right now. It'd probably be him. AB. I think you got to put Gannon up there. You probably got to put Nicklaus up there too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And then like someone that I would say is like second tier would be like a Matty O. Like Matty O, I don't think Matty O's ceiling is above AB's ceiling, but I think maybe Matty O's floor is a little bit higher than AB.
Yeah.
So like Matty O's never going to have like a round where he goes out and blows up and maybe AB goes out and has a bad round, right? So it's like every player is a little bit different, obviously playing style, skill levels. But yeah, I don't think anyone would ever argue that Andrew Presnell has a higher ceiling than Ricky.
I mean, well, I guess my whole point of asking that though is like saying, Who should be playing with whom then?
Well, I mean, are you thinking Andrew Presnell should be playing MA1?
No, certainly not.
Yeah, I don't either.
No, because he sandbags every once in a while to lower his ratings.
No, I mean, it's just like right now there are, you know, 100 really good disc golfers in the world. Maybe there's 150 really good disc golfers in the world. Maybe eventually there'll come a time where there's 1,000 really good disc golfers in the world. And maybe someone, you know, I think Andrew Presnell after this win, I think he's going to be on the up and up. But maybe 10 years from now, when there's 1,000 really good disc golfers that are, let's say, Andrew Presnell's skill level, maybe some of those guys aren't on tour because there's not enough spots for them.
Mm.
Right. And they're on a secondary tour that, you know, they're on this, whatever. I don't even know if this thing's happening yet. This qualifying tour or whatever. But right now, like we're seeing it in women's disc golf, right? Like women's disc golf is a perfect example of what the men's disc golf used to look like. Right. Like back in the day, men's disc golf, it was Ricky, Paul. It was like a handful of guys. Women's disc golf, back in the day, if you're like, hey, who's going to win this tournament? Who are you picking? Paige Pierce, Katrina Allen, and then you're throwing a third name in. Now, if you had to ask who's going to win this next tournament, obviously you're probably picking Krista Tatar.
She's the highest rated.
Those next two spots, what'd you say?
Because she's the highest rated.
Yeah, but those next two spots, who are you picking those next two spots?
Sure.
There's maybe 7, 8, 9 women now that you're throwing in there. So we're starting to see what is happening with the MPO field. We're starting to see in the FPO field where it's getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Right now, I mean, Andrew Presnell, Parker Welk, Johnny Buckets almost won multiple tournaments this year. We're starting to see multiple guys be able to win. And it's not just Paul or Ricky. It's not just, I mean, heck, Calvin didn't even win that much last year, right? Like it's so hard to win on tour now. Because there's just so many people you have to beat. You can't show up and have your, like, Ricky 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Who wins this tournament?
Yeah.
Like, he didn't play his best, and he would have won still. You can't do that anymore. There's too many good people.
There's no doubt that the
floor is higher.
Yeah, certainly. It's been
Which is wild exciting for everyone.
Watch it unfold, honestly.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. All right, man.
Hopefully I didn't sound like an idiot, and hopefully I made
No, you're good.
There is something to be said, and don't get me wrong, there are times when certain stats, and it doesn't have to be ratings related, just certain stats in general, when they come across, I'll say, my screen, I sometimes shrug a shoulder or give a light cringe or because they just don't hit me. Whether it's the time, whether it's just how the stat was contrived, whatever. And it's not because they're not necessarily true, but there's always like a little bit of meaning to it and there's some context to it. And I completely understand that. And I feel like the main point of your conversation is that just that the ratings are not a great indicator of the play that was given on a given weekend. Yeah. And we could look at something, we'll say more raw, like the score, and use that as a better storyteller.
Exactly. You look at the field and you have to assume to yourself, out of the 100 people in the field or 120 people in the field, not all 100 or 120 people played poorly.
Sure.
And like that thought too is also, I just don't think that's a great thought for people to like get into disc golf and like have a metric like that to be like, oh, everyone just sucked this week. Like, I don't think that's a really good way to look at it. And the rating gives you the ability to be like, oh wow, 1040 was the winner. Everyone just sucked. I don't like that. I don't think Andrew should be getting any sort of comments towards that. Like, he pulled off an incredible win on the hardest course in some of the toughest conditions we have played. And that should be the story that we should be pushing, and the ratings should not even be mentioned.
Yeah. And to your point, at no point did it, let me back up. There's some context, and at no point to me did I ever think in any way, shape, or form of diminishing the field or Andrew's accomplishment by saying, oh, he only averaged 1041 golf. That's me personally. And I understand that others may have come to Twitter and others may look at it from that perspective. But to me, that still goes back to a little bit of who's your audience and what's your context, because it just never even crossed my mind to mention or to be concerned with what the rating was for him or the rest of the field.
Because you could say the context is, he shot a 1040 round on a very high SSA course, and that should in theory give you more context to the whole deal like that. And again, I'm not harping on SSAs, but I'm just saying, if we want to give as much context as we can, that is how you give context. So, you know, someone who's in the know would know, oh, high SSA course, smaller ratings per point, blah, 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 versus, you know, your pitching. But it's a lot of information you have to relay.
But that also should just fact that if the ratings were actually good, that should be factored into the rating. You shouldn't.
Sure.
Like, if the ratings were actually constructed properly, you shouldn't have to be like, oh, it's 1040, but it's a high SSA. like how golf does it, that's all factored into the handicap. So if I go and I play a really hard course and I shoot eight over par, it factors that in already and it knows, wait, that's actually a really good round for you. Like that's all pre-factored in.
So
yeah, but as someone who doesn't know anything about golf, that does mean no good. If I hear you're shooting eight over, I'm like, oh, all right, he's shoots eight over. Like,
yeah, but that's where you literally say the rating out there was 80. And again, mm-hmm. like if you
you have to give context to your eight over that the rating is 80 and there's context, just like with a PDGA rating, you have to give context as to what maybe the SSA is. So
the other context is the same thing that we're saying here, that shooting mm-hmm. four under, if we said he shot four under, you'd be like, well, that's not really good. Yeah. But if you're like, hey, we shot four under at Northwood and you didn't know what Northwood was, would be like, well, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but we've gone,
Northwood was the hardest course in the world.
Yeah.
It's literally the same thing as golf.
Yeah. We're going round and round.
I shot eight over and you're going to be like, what? And I'll be like, well, that's one of the hardest golf courses in mm-hmm. the world. I shot eight over. And they'll be like, oh, that's pretty impressive.
So
like you're giving context in both scenarios.
We all should go, but I do have a question. What if you mathematically had no issues in terms of the financial development and or the mathematical development, what would you arrive at? Would you arrive at any rating system period? Like your dream rating system, what would that consist of? If you could wave a wand tonight before you go to sleep and wake up in the morning and be like, yep, here's the new rating system for all of disc golf. What would that look like to you? I'm just totally curious.
So it wouldn't be for the Pro Tour. So that wouldn't exist. But for the AMs, it would probably be something along the lines of like, once you have 15 scoreable rounds, and those rounds can be in tournament play or not in tournament play, because that's the other thing, is I don't think you need to always play in tournaments. However, if you do play in tournaments, it does give a little bit more weight, obviously, because there's a little bit more pressure, a little bit more
following of the rules, more seriousness. Harder. Yep.
Sure. And at the end of the day, you do that. And you obviously you can't like go out and play around by yourself in that count, but you have like, you know, witness or whatever. Mm-hmm. That way you don't have to pay a whole bunch of money to get a rating. And after 15 rounds or something like that, it starts taking into account your top, let's say 20% or 30% of your scores after 15 rounds. And then that is your rating. And then it literally drops off every year. So
how is your, no, back up though. And I follow that. What's the calculation though to get that rating? You just said take your top 20 or 30% of scorers, and it gives you your rating. Where's this rate? How is the rating derived?
Yeah, like, what's the math? This is where it would cost a whole lot of money to do, because you would have to basically, how golf has it done is golf actually has two systems. They have a rating and a slope. Mm-hmm. A rate, and this kind of goes back to my thing of where. A really good disc golfer playing a course is going to play a course way different than a really bad disc golfer. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as golf. If you guys stepped up to a hole, it's 150 yards and it's water carry, that might be a really hard hole for you. But to a good golfer, it's not a hard hole at all. So I shouldn't be rewarded that it's really hard for you guys and not hard at all for me. So you would have two different metrics. You would have a rating, which is based off of, let's say, a scratch golfer or a 1,000 rated golfer. And then you would have a slope, and that is based off of like your bogey golfer. And that's how golf does it. I think that makes the most sense. So that way you can go to a course like Memorial, for example. And Memorial, like let's say 1,000, let's say what a scratch golfer would shoot out there would be, I don't know, 10 under or something, let's say. And then, so you would have this number of where, I don't even know what the par is out there. That's why it gets really hard with disc golf.
56. Well, it's 56. There's two par fours.
Okay. So 46, if you're like a scratch golfer, you go out there, you shoot 46. And then the slope would be based off of like what a bogey golfer would be. So they would be two separate ratings or two separate metrics. And like the problem with that is like, I think it took a really long time for them to get a whole lot of golfers to play all these courses to get all this data points of how the course should play. Because again, I don't like the idea that ratings go based off like the weather conditions. I think it literally should just be very accurate. So that way everyone just knows like, oh, you know, 10 under par out at this course is a really good score. And not, oh, 10 under par is really good when it's windy or not windy or whatever. There's not really, to be honest, there's not really a fantastic way of doing it. That's why I just don't think it should exist on the Pro Tour. But on the AMs, I think literally the best way of doing it for right now, for what it's worth, is just, I like just having the ceiling cap at the top. Just give me the top 20 scores or top 20%, top 30%. And then that way, at least you know when you go into a tournament, you're not going to get absolutely boat raced by someone that can have a really good week and just basically be an MA1, but, you know, shoot the best score of the entire tournament and even beating the MPO players. Because that's like demoralizing, I think, right?
Well, it is, but I also think that only happens at really, obviously, at really small events. And it's rare.
Should I send you a bunch of screenshots?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like that happens very rarely.
Yeah, it's not happening at the Pro Tour for sure.
And there's something to be said about amateurs that maybe have whatever rating they are, but they're aspiring to try and go get some amateur title or whatever. So some of those players, if you find an MA2 guy that shoots, that's rated to be an MA2, and they shoot an MPO winning score, I would love to see that. I'm not saying it's not humanly possible, but okay, Something's wrong with your area and or your people, right?
Like, or you might have people like Johnny was saying that really like to win.
Or you have a 920 rated guy, and then the MPO guy is only rated 950 because he wanted to move to pro, you know, the first day that he possibly could, and he is only rated 950. And then there's an MA2 that's 920. I could see them beating it, but you shouldn't ever have a 920 rated MA2 player after two rounds on the exact same course beating a 1,000 rated MPO player. I have a hard time believing that happens. And if it does, it's once a year, because the MA2 guy that's rated 920 played out of his mind and had the greatest day of his life on the golf course. Like,
yeah.
That should be like a once in a year, once in a million rounds scenario. And I'm not.
I'll do some digging at some local C tiers and B tiers and see what I can find.
I think
you'll be really surprised with how many people will tell you like, no, their sandbagging is a problem in amateur.
I think there is some sandbagging problem. We've seen it even locally where a player gets good, doesn't ever want to go pro and continues to play amateur and can continue to play amateur as long as they want until they don't take cash.
As long as they don't take cash.
I don't know if that's sandbagging though. If they're playing at the highest amateur level, but they want to keep their amateur status, I'm talking more about like the MA3, MA2 guys that aren't moving up when they should.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that to me is sandbagging.
I agree. And I just don't feel like it happens.
Yeah. Okay.
So
not frequently.
All right. Well, we appreciate you jumping on.
I appreciate the
insight. Definitely. And it is absolutely a conversation that within the media realm, we can continue to discuss how the true significance or importance of the rating. And as you're saying, it should be far from an end all be all. And I don't think I've ever treated it that way, but I can understand that we should not give it too much credit or any at all. But
something we should give credit to, and maybe my opinion doesn't hold too much weight, but I think the commentary crew from the last tournament should be the one at mostly all the big events
from the
Champions
Cup.
Champions Cup. So
that was a really good commentary
from a live perspective.
You guys in the booth and Brian on the ground.
Mm.
I think a lot of people enjoyed it, myself included.
Well, thank you. There's always ways, and it's funny the conversations we have, you know, as a crew, the three of us, and obviously there's always ways to improve. And at the end of the day, I mean, you want to beat a dead horse about ratings, you could beat the dead horse about favorite or least favorite commentators, because that's just an argument. No one's winning ever. I've accepted that. And I think anyone that doesn't accept that is ultimately going to be an idiot, just because there's just, everyone has a different preference. And I read comments about, I hate this person. And then the next comment is, I love this person. And I don't understand where either of them are coming through, you know, coming from. And we're just never going to please everybody. But I mean, appreciate
it. Tony Romo was beloved.
For the first year.
Game. Yeah. People are like, this guy's incredible. And now everyone's like, get this guy off my TV. So
He made some crazy, right? Now I don't say crazy, some really good predictions about what was about to happen. And everyone saw that and was like, oh my God, this guy can just, he was built for this. He sees it. And you're right. Now there's quite a backlash against him.
They don't like him ruining? Is he spoiling?
No, not at all.
I think it's just people. They get tired of people. You got to have a hard head, and I give you hats off, Terry, because I know obviously the comments coming in, it's not easy to see those and then have to go back out there
Maybe it's a cheesy take, but there are literally Facebook groups with millions of people that are like, you know, the anti Joe Buck, I hate Joe Buck fan club that have 3 million likes. And then there's the same for another commentator and the same for the other. And guess what? Joe Buck tonight put his head down with probably plenty of money in his bank and will go do his job tomorrow, because that's all you can do. I mean, like,
you also always have a mute option.
That's true. That's very true.
But what is your commentator rating?
Oh gosh.
I'm just kidding. I don't want to talk about ratings anymore.
All right. Well, again, we do appreciate you joining us. I certainly appreciate the perspective. And it's definitely a good food for thought. Who knows who will pick it up or not. But it's definitely good food for thought, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always fun talking disc golf with you guys.
All right, man. Have a good night. Appreciate it. Good luck to Kelsey. Tell her that tomorrow.
That's right.
Appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Right.
See you. Good night.
Good night.
All right.
Yeah, it was like a whole nother show we just had.
I know, it's funny. And Galactic Conqueror says, oh God, Joe Buck. Exactly my point. The funny thing is, I
don't have a strong feeling for most commentators, football. A lot of people hate Chris Collinsworth.
Sure, exactly.
A lot of people like, I'm just saying, I don't have like a preference.
It's funny because I don't either.
Like, I
maybe
listen
because I'm not as impassioned about a lot of other sports.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why.
And you hear around here, a lot of people dislike Troy Aikman because they think he's
anti-Packers.
They think he's anti-Packers when honestly,
or anti-Rodgers or anti-Favre or anti-Packers.
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think a lot of people see what they want to see because he was a cowboy. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm just like, no, I think he's critical, but I think every commentator should be critical. I don't think I think he's beyond that in theory. Maybe he does, and I just don't see it.
I get my fair share of personal attacks. Sure, they'll keep coming.
I love when people are like, Terry, you're such a favorite to Macbeth. Or then there's like, oh, why do you hate Macbeth so much?
Yeah, it's funny. I was going to actually, that's even more so directed at Doss.
Yeah,
like the amount of times I read,
or that he favors discraft players is my favorite.
Yeah,
like Doss get
the Doss one is funny because the amount of times, and I'm going to tell the world, for maybe the 10th time, Doss wants the best play out of the best players, and when it comes down to actual personalities, he truly doesn't give a shit. Like, he wants the best golf and the best play and the best sportsmanship, and all he wants all of the best out of anyone. And you are, I'm just going to tell you point blank, because we have hours and hours of conversations, that when you say Doss hates Macbeth, you're dead wrong. And when you say Doss loves Macbeth, you're not dead wrong, but he loves Macbeth as much as he loves every other player.
He loves it when Macbeth is playing his best golf.
He wants the best golf by the best players on the best weekend by whomever that is. And he will cheer and commentate just the same for Wysocki playing his best as he would for Macbeth playing his best, as he would for Brody playing his best. He wants the best golf, and I just cannot stress that enough. So if in your back pocket, you're thinking, oh, you know, here's what I think. I'm just telling you from that perspective, Doss does not play favorites. It sounds harsh to say, but he just doesn't give a shit. He wants the best golf and the best play and the best scenarios. And that's why I do find it funny about him specifically, because I think it was even on Thursday, the day we were live on YouTube. Somebody's like, oh, it's so obvious how much Doss just always is ripping on Macbeth. He hates Macbeth. And then it was like an hour later, somebody's like, oh, God, I hate how much he favors Macbeth. He's always just talking about
making Macbeth. Excuses. And
yeah, or whatever. Like,
it's so funny.
And I'm sorry. I get worked up because I read those things and I know what's going through. I know what's going through his head, though, and how he's acting and truly how he feels. And then to have the internet be just so dead wrong on it is really frustrating.
Well, there's nothing new about the internet being dead wrong.
No, I mean, you guys are always right most days.
Our chat room is. just our Patreon,
you know, just like somebody said, if you do or don't like, you know, overall styles and this person and another, I'm also okay with that. Not everybody likes me. Not everybody likes Doss or Sexton or whomever. I get it. I totally get it. I'm not mad about that. But I will tell you, in a very specific case, Doss doesn't play favorites in that way. He doesn't play favorites towards Discraft. Like, I promise you that as well.
I was going
to
say,
there's things he may know more about one person or another to some degree, of course, from truly personal experiences. So he's going to know more about Paul Macbeth than he knows about Joseph Anderson, because he hasn't played around a disc golf with Joseph Anderson. He played on multiple lead cards for 5 years with Macbeth. So, yes, he's going to know more things and maybe have different insight, but it's not because he favors one over the other.
No. And again, I you'd be hard pressed if Doss even knows some of the Discraft sponsored players.
Yeah.
Like he probably wouldn't know if someone was a Discraft.
He didn't know this weekend.
I was going to say at the beginning of the year or the beginning of the round, if you asked him who is Andrew Presnell sponsored by, I wouldn't be shocked if he'd be like, like he probably knows, but. There's a few. That's why I hold no water in a lot of people saying like he plays favorites to anybody particularly.
I'll go as far as saying some people know people I dislike and you don't even know, because I would like to think I'm professionally at my best, trying to do my best job to keep any personal feelings aside.
Dude, I'm right fucking here.
Yeah, I know. No, I rip on you during the broadcast. there's people I don't care for, but
can I do a sideline check-in from Stephen's Point? It's like,
oh yeah, just Johnny. We're now going to checking in with Johnny V. He's on a backup on I-5, as they call it, out there in Standing Rocks. Johnny, how many par over are you?
Well, Terry, we're only three holes in.
So I'm four up.
So nope. Knowing those two holes, I'm actually at even par. But I know I-5, and I don't know if I've ever parred it in my life. Unfortunately, I just have had bad history with this hole, so I expect to be four over par after this hole, Terry. Thanks for the check-in.
Yeah.
All right.
Back to you.
All right, we're going to check in with our Patreon supporters, patreon.com/SmashboxTV. This was a good second show we just had with Brody. We have 135 people eligible for our giveaway tonight, and you can be eligible, as we said earlier in the regular show, by going to patreon.com/SmashboxTV or filling out that nice little form that we gave you earlier. I sorted it by email address tonight, Terry, so I would love for you to give me a number that I need to draw.
First one.
The very first one. All right. This is random.org. I'm going to hit generate. And our very first number is 55. 55. I will not dox anybody. I'll take that off screen. I'm going to scroll up to 55. And I see Harold Ande. A-N-D-E. Harold Ande. He is out of Texas. Harold. All right. And so maybe it's not.
No way. Does he? I'm going to mildly dox. He lives in the same city as a previous Patreon winner from maybe last week or the week before. The zip code's a little different because I sent it out today. Oh. And that is a very specific, specific city,
That's what they are, Terry. That's how the mail works.
In Texas, and it's not even what I assume to be a large city. So that's awesome. That is pretty random, considering I know I just sent it out today. That's all.
So maybe it's not on day. Maybe it's Harold Andy, depending if it's Texas.
Either way.
But either way, congratulations, Harold. Thanks for being a Patreon supporter. We love you.
Damn it, Carney. That's what I meant to spit out when you were talking about who you work for. I've been there, and I used to know somebody else that worked there. It's a whole nother long story for another day. But yeah, that's what I meant to say. And I, hence, you knew I was close because you're saying you're working for a Wisconsin-based company. And when you said Waterloo, I just spit out the wrong bike manufacturer, and that's the one I meant. So that's awesome. That's pretty funny. Like I said, I know someone of someone who used to work there. I don't know if they still do. Anyway, kind of funny. I think they actually technically installed or paid to have one of the nine holes nearby put in.
That makes sense.
Which is pretty cool of them. That is so funny. Anyway, I guess that's about it. I'll be at DDO, or as I'll try to refer to it every time this weekend, as Dynamic Disc Open, when I'm saying it in an official capacity. Okay,
it's going to be a little tongue twister.
Yeah,
Dynamic Disc Open. Are you going to mess up the course name?
Champions Landing?
You probably won't say it much.
I probably won't. So I probably won't mess it up.
Because I was just saying, like, someone's going to say we're here at the country club or something.
Yeah, or the ECC. I never got on the ECC train.
No, I was never an ECC.
But a lot of, every time you see it abbreviated anywhere, it says ECC.
Yeah.
But I never really got on board with actually saying that. So, yeah, I think I should be able to get on board with Champions Landing pretty quickly, hopefully.
Yeah.
We're finally over the GBO. the GBO.
There's been enough change where we've erased that change.
Yeah,
we've gone back,
but I am excited. Hopefully I'll have time to be able to go check out the Dynamic Disc warehouse, which now is, of course, a whole new situation with House of Discs and everybody else and things shipping out of there. I may do some wandering around. Maybe. Well,
I definitely want you to buy Rusko a drink for me. Whatever it is, I'll pay you.
Okay.
One drink. That's all he needs.
Yeah, that's a pitcher, right? One drink is a pitcher.
For you.
We'll see. All right. We do have to thank everyone. Thank you for Brody for jumping on very unexpectedly. But I am glad we both certainly understand his perspective. And I'm clear on what his perspective was, which is funny because I keep saying I don't entirely disagree. I don't really think I disagree at all. I think it's more so a mentality, a mind shift, and a way in which we approach some things. If he wants it to change, it comes from how much emphasis and recognition we do put on the ratings in the first place. If we just don't emphasize or talk about them
Let's quit talking about ratings right now.
Okay.
And then Kristen Starr never gets to 1,000.
That's it.
Poor girl.
We wish. I wish you guys all the best of luck in whatever your new rating will be. Thanks for joining us. That's podcast 504s. Sounds weird. After show for Johnny VM, the Disc Golf Guy. I'll see you guys at Champions Landing at the Dynamic Disc Open. We'll see you next week.